opportunity without the funding, marketing, distribution, and production capabilities of your larger company. But you know better than they do what your customers really need and want. And you get a reasonable but fair share of the profits, which are directly measured through your or your small team's efforts through real-time information systems. This is totally possible with current technologies. Most managers and supervisors simply prefer to boss their people around and have control over them. It helps them feel important. Supervisors and top-down managers are dead. Coaches, trainers, and facilitators are what workers need, not second-guessing, pinheaded bureaucrats. Companies just don't want to share this information with employees because they're as reluctant to relinquish control as the French nobles before their massacre and the People's Revolution. Information systems can today enhance everyday workers and turn them into entrepreneurs and profit creators, not just rote production or office workers. And they must, because the higher-paying jobs of the past are gone forever. And workers should worry more about AI and software automation of left-brain tasks than about competing with assembly line workers in third-world countries or illegal immigrants here. No tricks in tax cuts or deregulation or trade negotiations will bring these jobs back substantially. The assembly line is very old technology now. It was invented by Henry Ford in 1914. It's time to move on to something greater. And that is the information-enhanced, entrepreneurial, customizing, monomaniac with a mission. We need to wake up and become what we are, what computers can likely never become, creative, entrepreneurial, relational human beings. Such information systems make employees both more accountable for results and more rewardable for their direct contributions. This is a win-win for corporations and employees. Who needs unions in that scenario? Except to be a funnel for ideas from workers who could create better products and higher profits, and make sure they get their fair share of such newly created profits. Jack Stack's World. Okay, I admit that I have delayed getting to this story so I could keep you listening, but I'll end this chapter with the entrepreneur and author I most admire, and that's saying a lot, with my experience consulting for and studying them. Let's look at a successful entrepreneur and manager who really gets it, Jack Stack. He wrote one of my favorite books ever, called The Great Game of Business, way back in 1992, the same time I wrote The Great Boom Ahead. Damn, being an innovator takes decades to prove out. It's frustrating. That book was about how to teach every worker to think like and become a business owner. As I quoted him earlier, nobody knows the job better than the guy who is doing it. Well, he damn well followed through and proved his concepts in real life. He took over a failing manufacturing company in Springfield, Missouri, and turned many of its workers into blue-collar millionaires. Screw slightly higher minimum wages. Jack Stack has paid out more than $100 million in ownership shares to workers. His company, SRC Holdings, is wholly owned by his 1,600 employees. They manufacture engines and components for trucks, tractors, and heavy equipment. You know, the type of manufacturing industry where we're losing jobs to foreign competition and automation. And on top of that, SRC has launched 60 companies, ranging from banking to medical devices to furniture. Jack's premise is very simple. You can boost performance by making a game of tracking and improving key metrics, i.e. real-time information systems, delivered directly to workers. If you want employees to act like owners, he says, you should make them owners. Taking it even one step closer to complete transparency, the company's financials are available for everyone to see. There's no top-down control and secrecy. The results, according to Jack's figures, are astounding. A guy who started here in 1983 making $7.50 an hour has now got $1.2 million. That's on average, I presume. Talk about the American dream. Talk about making us great again. This is the entrepreneurial revolution we need, the one we're already on the road toward. It's just that most of corporate America doesn't see it yet. Jack's secret is not just to reward people for their profit contribution in the great game of business. It's to put real numbers right in workers' faces so they make better decisions every minute, every day, for every customer. I would go one step further, and maybe Jack already has. I would give employees a minor share in the overall company. But I would also then use software to measure each individual's or team's contributions after fair overhead allocations and direct costs. This would mean the backline servers have fair revenue recognition of their efforts on behalf of the frontline browsers, who actually serve the end customers. Is this not possible in a light-speed world of software and business metrics? We need more real business leaders and visionaries like Jack Stack, not BS Wall Street leverage artists or old-line corporate managers who merely streamline their top-down management systems while their workers wait for their unfunded retirement and death. And we need real educators, like Neil deGrasse Tyson, who can make science understandable to everyday people. Most of all, we need people to love what they do so much that they won't even think of retiring at age 63 or 65 or even 75. They're so productive and happy that they don't worry about a retirement that doesn't make sense to them anymore, though it's there if they have health challenges. They're too busy satisfying their customers and creating new businesses to contemplate life without that fulfillment. They're so focused on what they do that they're like the champion basketball player who's totally in state and one with his process. They're certainly not bored or waiting to retire and do nothing. My 500-year cycle says the future is brighter than demographic trends now project. That gives me a clear vision that, first, a revolution in work and retirement is emerging. And further down the line, we'll see a revolution in how long we live and contribute to offset the declining birth and demographic trends that otherwise seem irreversible in an ever more affluent and urban world with low birth rates. But it will be this revolution in work and institutions at all levels that will first regenerate our aging developed countries and then filter down into the faster-growing emerging ones. Emerging countries will always be taking over the older technologies and business systems at lower labor costs, which is why we have to focus on the newer ones. Of course, this process will be painful for many companies and governments for many years ahead. But it will mean the greatest freedom granted to everyday people since the advent of democracy itself. Now, regarding the greatest top-down bureaucracy of all, government must change. And radically. 22 government reforms that must happen. Reform 1. The Glass-Steagall Act was repealed during the Clinton administration. After several decades, people had forgotten why it was instated in the first place. To prevent conflicts of interest in banking and financial services that helped create the bubble and Great Depression that followed. We simply must separate the functions of major financial institutions, placing walls between traditional banking, investment banking, and brokerage services, without which we get conflicts of interest with harmful effects for the economy and consumers. Banks take deposits and lend money. They don't create investment funds or have brokerage accounts. There should be simple, ironclad rules about reserve ratios for banks, which should be higher. Say 20% instead of 10%, with appropriate down payments required on loans, like 20%. Income verification is always required, as the banks are really lending consumers and businesses money, not their own, and should be responsible fiduciaries of that money. Investment banks raise money for investment in companies and IPOs. They don't speculate in investments outside of that, like Goldman Sachs. Brokerage firms offer brokerage accounts and financial advice. They don't manage or offer investments. That's a conflict of interest with their customers, to be shoving their own products down customers' throats in the name of objective financial advice. Seriously, how can they be unbiased when they're pushing their own investments and funds? That leaves investment management firms, but they can't give financial advice or offer brokerage accounts. investments are delivered to end consumers through automated online or human retail brokerage firms. During this revolution, we'll likely see these distinctions brought back. Reform 2. Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid have to change their qualification or retirement ages from 65 to 75 over the next 10 to 20 years, in line with our much longer lives. Thereafter, it should continue to be extended every 5 years for increased life expectancy in the future. This will keep consumers in the workforce longer, producing and earning and consuming more, paying into the system longer, and retiring for 12 years on average, instead of the 22 years they get today. No one should do nothing for 22 plus years. That's enough to kill you from boredom and uselessness. And this is the only way to preserve such benefits in the future for the time you do need to wind down your life and deal with health challenges. The present system isn't even remotely viable, given the slowdown ahead and the increased pressure on the system, as baby boomers squeeze through it and our economy slows in the years and even decades ahead as compared with the past, according to my four fundamentals. Reform 3. The government should actively encourage and reward restructuring of consumer and business debt and return to mark-to-market rules for loans. Such a new approach to debt deleveraging would be taking a cue from the very successful Chapter 11 process in the private sector. The normal Chapter 7 bankruptcy process just sells the assets of a failing company to pay off the creditors, but typically results in fire sales and low levels of payback. Chapter 11 is allowed for companies that are viable if they can reduce their debt and costs. This process protects the company from creditors for a while and allows it to sell off assets at better than fire sale prices, cut costs, and renegotiate with creditors, all of which most often yields a win-win for all parties. The Great Depression was like a Chapter 7 debt deleveraging for the economy. Not the best way to approach a failing economy. As this revolution unfolds and we see a financial crisis between now and 2020, the government could choose to work with the banks to implement more of a Chapter 11 restructuring of debt so that fewer banks and companies would have to fail altogether. Debt has been accumulated way beyond present and future needs. Writing such debts down would give great long-term relief to consumers and businesses, which would help offset the natural demographic slowdown. In the 1930s and 40s, private debt went from 180% of GDP in 1929 down to 60% shortly after World War II. That's the very purpose of deflation and depressions, to deleverage debt and financial bubbles. Reform 4. We can't return to the gold standard for countless reasons, many of which I wrote about in my ebook, How to Survive and Thrive During the Great Gold Bust Ahead. But we absolutely need ironclad standards regulating how much debt can grow versus GDP. Debt should be allowed to grow modestly more than GDP, in line with rising incomes and creditworthiness. And debt should be allowed to grow a bit more when larger percentages of consumers are in their prime home buying and debt acquiring years, between the ages of 27 and 41. This is what happened between 1988 and 2001, and it was totally predictable based on demographic data. However, today it's not the case at all. What needs to happen is that the Federal Reserve should curb excessive debt by raising reserve requirements or absolute limits when debt exceeded such GDP-related and demographic targets. The best solution here would be the emergence on a large scale of the Bitcoin-like blockchain technologies, such that some of these companies could become highly efficient new creators of money and currency. But that would occur only in response to real transaction needs, not from governments trying to cheat and overstimulate their economies, cover up debt failures, and lower their export costs by devaluing their currencies. Reform 5. Special interest lobbying should simply be banned. No more, ever, again. It's unbelievably corrupting to the political system. In fact, it's been the very worst assault on democracy and free market competition. If Congress needs studies on the impacts of a political issue or a bill, it should employ an independent firm to do so, with federal, state, or local governments covering the cost. Companies can send their analysis, but they can't spend money pushing or entertaining or bribing lawmakers. Reform 6. Campaign finance should be reformed such that there are clear limits on personal donations to restore democracy, just like each person gets an equal vote. Corporations should no longer be treated as individuals, per the Supreme Court decision in 2015. This would create very clear limits for corporate donations as well, possibly scaled somewhat by profit levels. No more billionaires like the Koch brothers deciding who gets to run for president or Congress in their party. They vetoed Romney in the 2016 primary. Reform 7. The political system should be as neutral as possible relative to economic policies. There should be no subsidies for debt, like the mortgage deduction. Capital gains shouldn't be taxed at preferential rates, except possibly for new ventures and IPOs that actually create new jobs. Holding an already issued stock for 1 year does little or nothing for job creation and shouldn't enjoy any favor. Financial transactions should be taxed at low rates to hit the most affluent more. Taxing investments is a better way to hit the rich than dramatically taxing higher incomes. That just funds countless tax lawyers and accountants who game the system, only complicating business and decision-making further and adding costs. And it can work against innovation incentives to a degree. Let businesses and consumers make better decisions based on market rates and feedback, not on tax advantages and endless incentives from governments to support this or that special interest or goal. Municipalities shouldn't be tax-exempt on their bond interest. Corporations and municipalities should be allowed to deduct interest as a cost of doing business, like everything else. And again, no lobbying by corporations and special interests to influence political decisions and laws. Deductions for charitable contributions should be much more narrowly defined in terms of things governments would do with tax money, like help the poor, rather than people's own religious or personal dreams. Better yet, they could be eliminated altogether. Reform 8. The Federal Reserve shouldn't set short-term interest rates. They can be lowered temporarily only in emergencies, defined as recessions with greater than 10% unemployment or something like that. Quantitative easing to directly inject liquidity and to impact longer-term rates should be allowed for only short periods of time, 1 year maximum, in response to recessions with greater than 10% unemployment. It shouldn't become a semi-permanent policy that totally perverts markets and investments and prevents needed rebalancing, debt deleveraging, and innovation, as was the case between 2008 and 2016 in the United States. Reform 9. Instead of endlessly complex pollution regulations, we need to simply set a fair and statistically determined tax on carbon and other pollutants that reflect actual down-the-line costs to the economy. Then let businesses make better decisions about how they minimize their carbon footprint rather than having detailed specs and bureaucracy for everything companies and consumers do. Use those tax revenues to counter such pollution and global warming. If the taxes are too onerous, then normal income and sales taxes could be cut to help offset them. Total taxes could stay near the same, while businesses and consumers would have incentives to make better decisions for the economy on energy use and pollution factors, with less bureaucracy and complexity. Reform 10. A very basic level of Medicare needs to be determined that is universal, establishing a one-payer system. Restrictions need to be put on government-funded operations and care for people who have limited life expectancy of, say, less than 1 year. Above that, people can choose to pay for higher private insurance. Estimates are that up to 50% of healthcare costs are paid in the last year of life. That is an unfair burden on younger people. Individuals can make their own choices above that for private insurance or funding, including care in the restricted last year of life or whatever period is determined to be optimal. Our healthcare costs are roughly double those of other developed countries, and our life expectancy is one of the lowest. The private sector has simply failed here, largely due to special interests and lobbying that have created so many hidden costs, bureaucracy, and unjustifiable advantages. Reform 11. Hedging for businesses should be allowed through leveraged futures and the like, but should not be encouraged for use in speculation. There should be much stricter limits on margin debt, with either no leverage or 2-to-1 leverage at most, except for legitimate hedgers protecting downside risks. Warnings about opening trading accounts should be as strong as those on cigarettes. Reform 12. Credit default swaps should be eliminated or much more restricted. They are designed to be insurance for downside risk in financial assets, but there's no collateral, so it's not real insurance. Collateral should be defined and required for credit default swaps that are allowed. Reform 13. The federal budget must be balanced over rolling 5-year periods. At least modest surpluses should be mandated in times when economic growth is averaging 2% or higher. Deficits should be allowed in recessionary times only to the extent that they are covered by surpluses accrued in the past, plus a maximum of 3% or so of GDP in recessionary years. Social programs like welfare should not be allowed to become permanent. And if someone cannot get a job, they should at least do some public service to compensate. The United States also cannot continue to police the world and subsidize military spending of our allies. Reform 14. Trade deficits should also be balanced over rolling 5-year periods. No country should be allowed to run endless trade deficits. Reform 15. The education system must be reformed to reduce excessive real estate costs. This can happen through greater use of online teaching where appropriate, and live teaching only where necessary. Teachers should take on the role of helping students identify their greatest aptitudes and interests, and design their curriculum accordingly, that is, customizing them to individual needs. Tenure has to be reformed and/or abolished. Universities should sell excess real estate and facilities to businesses and research firms, and/or conduct paid research for them to reduce tuition fees. Reform 16. Political campaigns should be shorter, between 6 weeks and 3 months, instead of the typical 1 to 2 years. As it currently stands, it wastes resources and takes lawmakers' attention off of making laws effectively. Reform 17. There needs to be simple but effective regulation of advertising. There are too many exaggerated unproven claims and too much money spent on appealing to people's subconscious desire for heaven on earth. Advertising and marketing should be educational and help consumers make better decisions, not manipulative and misleading, as, sorry to say, most are. Reform 18. Rewards for damages in business, healthcare, and so on should be limited to real damages and not winning the lottery. No matter how good a business or a doctor is, there will always be mistakes. Even our genes have mutations, and Xerox machines fail here and there. Occasional failures should be expected and tolerated more by the system. Excessive failures or irresponsible conduct should be punished to the full extent of the law, but it shouldn't be a case of awarding people multi-million dollar settlements for vague damages or unquantifiable pain and suffering. Reform 19. Illegal immigration should be stopped to the extent possible, something President Trump is trying to accomplish, although I don't agree with how he's going about it. Already present illegals should have something like 2 years to apply and qualify for residency or citizenship, or be deported. Simply sending 11 million plus immigrants back is impossible, unbelievably costly, and very disruptive to businesses and families. Sorry, Trump. Such a mass deportation would cause a deep recession from the lost spending and lost production of such workers. Like Australia and Canada, we should target the skills we want and need, and then favor for entry those immigrants who possess such credentials. We should encourage highly educated foreign students to stay, not put quotas on them. And there are lower skills that we need as well, so this does not mean cutting large numbers of legal immigrants, as Trump has proposed. In the future, children of illegal immigrants should not be automatically naturalized. They have to apply like anyone else. That creates too big an incentive for continued illegal immigration. Reform 20. If there is one thing that deserves subsidies, it's child care. Countries like France and Sweden have found that reducing child care costs does more for the economy than liberal maternity leave or tax credits for having kids. When kids cost more than $250,000 to raise, what does a $5,000 tax credit matter? This is the greatest challenge for working mothers and their conflict between work and having kids. Child care costs, like health care and education, are insanely high in the United States. This needs to change. Reform 21. Hackers should be treated like the terrorists they are. They pose a much greater threat than global and internal terrorists by threatening the internet and communications and transaction systems that we all have come to depend on. They treat this like a game. It should be a very serious crime, with much stronger enforcement and penalties. Otherwise, we could see a major breakdown of the system at some point. Reform 22. The Secretary of State and the President of the United States should push much harder for free trade rules globally, but these rules must have teeth and be enforceable. Countries like Japan shouldn't be able to manipulate their currency and purposefully push it down to make their exports more competitive. That is cheating. Countries like China and India shouldn't be able to pollute to massively higher levels to save costs. That is cheating. Being poor should not be an excuse for excessive polluting and not recycling your waste. Pirating software and technology is cheating. If you don't play by the rules, you don't get to play the game, and your trading rights are restricted or even eliminated. I'm again talking about simple rules, not a new global bureaucracy. And some economist has to come up with a better way of settling trade imbalances. Floating exchange rates can make a good company uncompetitive overnight, or make a country more expensive to visit for no good reason. More stable, large-scale, bottom-up digital currencies could emerge to address this need. To summarize, regulations should be simple rules of the game that keep competition fair and communications open and honest. They shouldn't be endlessly detailed and onerous. Set simple rules and guidelines, tax pollutants, and let businesses and consumers make better decisions. And then let the courts settle the fine lines of disputes when necessary, with stronger laws to counter frivolous lawsuits that exploit and jam up the system. Said a simpler way, it's time that central banks, lobbyists, politicians, and governments get out of the way and let our economy follow its natural course. A course that leads us right into the jaws of a necessary financial crisis and deleveraging after the greatest debt and financial bubble in history. And beyond that, a revolution greater than the emergence of democracy itself. It's all about designing systems to take out the bureaucracy and allow businesses and governments to deliver real-time, personalized service at affordable prices and to organize around your customers, not your backline BS bureaucracy. It's ultimately about operating from the bottom up, not the top down. That's the real revolution. And that requires the automation of management and the empowerment of the frontline workers with the information they need to satisfy their customers without idiotic supervisors. But the real bottom line for governments in the free world during this revolution is this. Special interests have taken over democracy, with large corporations and the top 0.1 to 1% enjoying undue influence to further their own interests. That has to stop. No more lobbyists or lobbying. No more big donations to campaigns. Donations should be limited to $1,000 or something like that. Central banks have overwhelmed free markets by trying to create an economy that never has a recession and never has to rebalance excesses of the past. In doing so, they've created greater bubbles that benefit the same top 1% who massively outperformed, just like in the Roaring Twenties, and have contributed to the excessive special interests impact. That, too, must stop. And I think that it will when this totally artificial third extreme bubble crashes between late 2017 and early 2020+. I would encourage voters to never trust central banks again, as they learned not to trust the aristocracies that controlled most Western economies into the 1700s. The truth is that we don't need central banks, except in emergencies, for short-term liquidity. They should never be allowed to create money at will or manipulate the economy or free markets again. It is the very marriage of democracy and free market capitalism that has made us so unbelievably rich since the late 1700s. The information revolution can amplify that if we don't keep killing the golden goose. But we do need to address the slowing demographic trends as the massive baby boom generation ages. And we do need to find a way to restructure our massive debt, which is still mostly private, as would a business in a Chapter 11 debt reorganization. Our governments could help facilitate that by assisting only the banks that actually write down debts in this next financial crisis, rather than endlessly printing money to cover over such debts and losses. That means many banks and businesses will still go under, but the numbers won't be as extreme as in the national Chapter 7 crisis of the 1930s. It's time to take our medicine and move on to the next spring season, unlike Japan has done. It is proven that 20 years of more stimulus and debt does not cure the addiction, but has only made it worse, and Japan has worse to come. China will, when it falls, finally prove once and for all that top-down governments that expand at will only get more inefficient and more in debt, and fall harder. Bubbles always burst, and we are near the top of the greatest global bubble in modern history, led by China. Part 2. The Invisible Yet Blatant Bubble. Chapter 9. There's no bubble here? Stocks are more overvalued today than they were in 2000, at the peak of the dot-com bubble. Anyone who can't see that is blind. Harry Dent. The cheerleaders are bouncing around, waving pom-poms and chanting, "No bubble, no bubble, no, no bubble!" Janet Yellen's one of them. So is Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, who said earlier this year on Squawk Box, "We are not in bubble territory." They should be shouting a different chant. "We're number one, can't be number two, and we're going to beat the whoopsie out of you." When this bubble bursts, and we are in a bubble, and it will burst, it's going to absolutely beat the whoopsie out of those ignoring the obvious. Economist Robert Shiller developed the best valuation indicator thus far. The Nobel laureate's cyclically adjusted price-earnings ratio is known as the Shiller PE, or CAPE. Shiller's CAPE shows that we are clearly in bubble territory, yet even he doubts it. Eventually, everyone joins in the bubble mania. He uses the average of the past 10 years' earnings to smooth out wild fluctuations near tops, and when earnings suddenly crash in major recessions or depressions. This makes the model more reliable than the simple price-to-earnings ratio, PE. Only a blind person couldn't see that we're deep in danger territory. We've gone higher only twice before, and there are specific reasons for that, which I'll explore shortly. We saw peaks in 1902, 22.9, 1929, 32.6, 1937, 22.2, 1966, 23.9, 2000, 44.2, and 2007, 27.5. Now we're at 29.3 and rising, with likely another 10% coming in the Trump rally, which is based on the totally false hope that anything could create 3-4% growth again in an aging and massively over-indebted country. That's higher than all but two previous peaks, and nearly as high as the one in 1929. By the time this Trump rally tops out later this year, we'll likely be right at that 1929 peak. So by saying that we're not in a bubble, are the experts insinuating that 1929 wasn't a bubble? That the 90% crash, the greatest in U.S. history, was just bad luck? A black swan? It certainly seems that way. But then again, most people can see a bubble only with 20/20 hindsight. That's because, as I explain in The Sale of a Lifetime, most people don't want to see a bubble. They want to believe they've found heaven and can stay there forever. They want to continue getting something for nothing while their stocks and home prices rise irrationally. And most people don't understand the cycles that lead to bubbles. But when you take off the blinders, it's easy to spot how deep in the whoopsies we are. Nothing is more predictable than major bubbles. The hard part is predicting when the irrationality will finally end and burst. The most likely time, as of the writing of this book, would be in the classic crash season, around late October of 2017. Yes, P.E. ratios were much higher in 1999, but that was during a time when my four key cycles were all moving up together. Moving into the next greatest peak, into 1929, only three were moving up together. Between 1995 and early 2000, the U.S. economy was at its best. The baby boomers were in their peak spending acceleration. All was well, relatively speaking, around the world geopolitically. And the internet was soaring into the mainstream, juicing productivity, just as autos had in the roaring 20s. Today, we are in exactly the opposite position. As I explained in Chapter 5, since 2014, those four key cycles have pointed down. This means that ratios at the levels we're seeing in 2017 are even more dangerous than those we saw in 2000. I'll briefly explain in a moment, but let's get back to Shiller. Shiller is the only mainstream economist I respect and follow. Lacey Hunt is my favorite, but he's too realistic and contrarian to be called mainstream. Besides his CAPE indicator, he was the first to adjust U.S. home prices for inflation and demonstrate once and for all that it is a non-appreciating asset in real terms. Real estate, as he proved, is not the great investment most assume it is. Neither is gold, but at least you can garner rent or save rent from owning real estate. People mistakenly form the idea that real estate was the ultimate investment because we've lived in unique times, when the first middle-class generation, the Bob Hopers, who could more broadly afford homes, boosted home buying after World War II. They could also afford mortgages, thanks to the GI Bill. The greatest inflation surge in modern history followed, a result of the baby boomers joining the workforce, as I explained in Chapter 7. And real estate correlates directly to inflation, which Shiller proved. The biggest generation in history, baby boomers went on a massive home buying spree in unprecedented numbers. All of this lifted home prices to the moon, ending in the greatest bubble in history, between early 2000 and early 2006. But those good old days are gone. The boomers are shuffling off into the sunset, and real estate prices will never again enjoy the explosion they did between 1983 and 2005. How can they, when we'll have increasingly more dyers than buyers into the early 2040s? As I discuss in Chapter 3 of The Demographic Cliff, two simple charts, Shiller's inflation-adjusted home prices back to 1890 and my net demand, peak buyers at age 41 minus dyers at age 79, will tell you more about real estate trends than the rest of economic research combined. But I digress. We'll talk real estate in Chapter 11. Pundits also use Shiller's CAPE indicator, but they're using it to say that we're not in bubble territory yet because we're not remotely close to the 44.2 peak of 2000. This just reveals their lack of research and deeper understanding of cycles. Schiller's Cape is higher today than it was at four major peaks, 1902, 1937, 1966, and 2007. After each of those tops, stock investors were mauled, yet those peaks ranged between only 22 and 24. The lofty 32.6 peak of 1929 was just slightly higher than today's 29.3. And, like I said, I think we could get as high as that 1929 level before the wheels come off this bus for good. If you look at the simple PE, it's easy to see why Schiller adjusts the earnings for cyclicality. If you don't, such an indicator is largely useless. It's higher near the end of a crash, as in 2009, again due to the sudden crash in earnings, than at the top, when you need the warning. There was a series of peaks between 22 and 23 in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, all lower than where we sit now, at 29.3. But those peaks came when earnings were crashing, as during 1920 to 22 and 1930 to 33. In late 1929, when the crash started, the indicator was at a mere 18. So stocks are not overvalued now at 29? Clearly, the experts are bubble blind, and cycle blind to boot. The difference cycles make. Remember my four fundamentals from Chapter 5? Let's do a quick comparison, using these four cycles of the 1925 to 29 bubble, the tech bubble of 1995 to early 2000, which the experts are using as evidence that we're nowhere near any danger zone right now, and the current bubble. The 45-year innovation cycle peaked in 1920, precisely with the peak of the railroad industry. It then turned down into 1942. The 39-year generational spending wave pointed up strongly into late 1929, with a massive generation of immigrants. Then it crashed, and had a secondary high, from demographic trends again in 1937, before crashing once more. The 34-year geopolitical cycle turned up in 1915 and peaked in 1930, converging with demographic trends through late 1929. The 10-year boom-bust cycle turned up in late 1923 and peaked in late 1929. Then it crashed into late 1933, the depths of the Great Depression. So three of my four key indicators converged in an upward arc from late 1923 into late 1929. The actual bubble phase was late 1924 through late 1929. All four of them headed downward simultaneously from late 1930 into 1933. At the peak, the Schiller Cape indicator reached an unprecedented 32.6, while the normal P/E ratio hit only 18 at the top, and then spiked up to 27 when earnings suddenly crashed. These four cycles converged again from late 1988 into early 2000, wherein we saw the greatest stock bubble since the Roaring Twenties. The generational spending wave turned up from late 1982 through late 2007. The 45-year innovation cycle turned positive from late 1988 through 2010. The geopolitical cycle headed up from late 1982 into 2001, with 9/11 as its first warning bell. And the boom-bust cycle was up from August 2009, when the Great Recession bottomed, until February 2014, and has pointed down since then, with a bottom projected around early 2020. All four cycles were heading up, together, into early 2000. This put the tech bubble in the most favorable period in history, even more so than the Roaring Twenties bubble, the greatest before it. That's why we witnessed the highest ever valuations. It was baked into the cycles cake. But all four cycles have been in their negative turn since early 2014, and those trends will persist into early 2020. The impact of the geopolitical cycle on stocks alone is to have valuations at its bottom compared with its top. Based on this cycle, high P/E ratios of 22 to 24 would be more normal at this point, with dot-com era peak ratios of 44.2 unattainable. We're already at 29.3, but again, we'll likely see that ratio 10% or so higher before this crazy bubble and blow-off Trump rally finally peaks. It's a very different world today than it was in the 2000s. There should be no comparison to that early 2000 peak and its valuation levels. Our economy isn't even half as good as it was back then. It's like comparing diamonds to cut glass. I often show the figure 9-4 chart on the PDF to prove that we're in a bubble today, no matter what those cheerleaders try to convince us of. The economic fall bubble boom season is where bubbles come once in a lifetime due to falling inflation and interest rates, killer technologies moving mainstream, and the strongest demographic trends that are often enhanced by openness to immigration. The boom since late 1982 has seen four bubbles and crashes, more than any boom in history, and with each successive crash being deeper than the last. The greatest one is just ahead, into the full-on economic winter season. This chart shows that the recent one, since early 2009, tops them all, in pure point terms, as well as based on percentage gains. Look at the S&P 500 in the current bubble, and compare it with that index during the tech bubble, which everyone agrees was a bubble. See for yourself how this bubble is longer, more stretched, and just as steep. Also notice that each successive crash has been deeper, 40% after 1987, 51% after 2000, 56% after 2007. So don't you think this final and most dramatic bubble will see a bigger crash? If you can't see that this is a bubble, you might literally be blind. It's not only the longest bubble in the series of four bubbles since the 1983 economic fall bubble boom commenced, but it's by far the largest point gain, and, just recently, the greatest percentage gain. By the time this irrational and final blow-off phase of the Trump rally peaks later in 2017, it will be off the charts, with valuations closer to 1929. You don't want to be holding stocks in such a scenario. Period. As different as night and day. The so-called experts' inability to see the bubble we're clearly in comes down to a lack of understanding, and maybe even a lack of appreciation, of how different our economy is today from that of the late 1990s and early 2000, when the dot-com bubble peaked at record valuations. I found a great summary courtesy of Michael Leibowitz of 720 Global on how different our economy and earnings growth really has been in recent years. Listen to the differences between the 1995-99 boom and 2012-16. GDP growth was 4.08% from 1995 to 1999. From 2012 into 2016, it was just 1.9%, less than half. Estimates for 2017 put it at near 2%. Five-year earnings growth was 7.53% between 1995 and 1999. Between 2012 and 2016, it was minus 3.84%. Five-year growth was 9.50% as compared with 0.49%. How could a stock market have such high valuations with such low earnings growth? Our federal debt is now $20 trillion. Versus $5.36 trillion in 1999, while deficits are 3.29% of GDP versus 0.33% in the earlier period. And then there's productivity. Between 1995 and 1999, it was at 1.84%. By 2016, it was limping along at 0.49%. With further retirements and aging ahead, I think it's heading to zero or lower. This clearly is not the same economy we enjoyed back in the late 1990s. Valuations today cannot reasonably or rationally be compared with those back then. Ratios of 44.2 times earnings were extreme but possible back then. Not today. There's another way to look at this. Using a chart that adjusts the CAPE ratios for GDP growth trends, the picture is clear. P/E ratios are higher than ever, much higher than in 1999 if you adjust for lower growth and economic momentum. And if that's not proof enough, there's another valuation indicator that I like. This one's from John Hussman, an excellent analyst. Also known as the Warren Buffett Valuation Indicator, it compares the expected 10-year average return given the current measure of total market valuation of publicly traded corporations as a percentage of GDP. This indicator shows that, without my projections of falling demographic, innovation, and geopolitical trends, if you buy stocks at today's very high valuations, you should expect 1.5% average annual losses over the next decade. That will only increase to 3 to 5% average annual losses if stocks advance another 5 to 10%, as I expect they will by around late October of 2017. Why take the risks in such an overvalued market with rising volatility? The very low or negative returns aren't worth it. I expect stocks to do worse than this, given the rare downward convergence of my four key economic indicators and the unprecedented debt and asset bubbles that must and will burst. This indicator and others Hussman studies clearly show that you shouldn't take any unnecessary risks in this market. The next boom will be nothing like the last one. I called the 1983 to 2007 boom the greatest in modern history because it was generated by the largest generational and demographic surge, and it was augmented by powerful internet and portable computing technologies, which were like the modern-day printing press. My three longer-term cycles converged between late 1988 and early 2000. Two of the three converged from late 1982 into 2007. The sunspot cycle oscillates more often and spends more of its time on the downside, but it chimed in from mid-1986 through early 2000, and again from late 2009 through early 2014. Projecting these four fundamentals, I see demographic trends globally diverging, with most developed countries pointing down for as long as we can see, and all emerging countries except China pointing up into at least 2040. Some, like the sub-Saharan Africa nations, keep going up into as late as 2100. The largest up-and-comer, India, points up into around 2065 and peaks around the same time that the collective emerging world does. The 45-year innovation cycle points down from late 2010 into mid-2032. That's a long time before it turns up around 2055. That's when we will likely see the first stage of what I call the aging revolution, where we start to live longer, to as late as 120, and our workforce cycle stretches from 43 years, ages 20 to 63, to 80 plus, ages 22 to 102 plus. That increased lifespan would reverse the ever-growing demographic black hole of lower than replacement birth rates. Just retiring at age 75 today, in line with our already higher life expectancies, would make a big difference in demographic cycles. But here's a big difference. The 34-year geopolitical cycle largely runs counter to the innovation cycle. It turns up in early 2020 and points up into around 2036, then turns down again into around 2053. The 45-year innovation cycle points down into 2032 and then turns up into 2055, almost perfectly opposite. We won't see the convergence of cycles that we saw from late 1988 through early 2000, and less so from late 1982 through late 2007, at least not for many decades. The generational spending wave in the United States turns up in two waves for the millennials. the first from early 2023 into late 2036, the second from early 2044 into around 2056. The three longer-term cycles converge only between mid-2032 and late 2036, and between 2052 and 2055, a few brief periods. The second wave of demographic spending trends takes the United States no higher than the first wave, adjusted for inflation. And the first wave takes us no higher than the peak of the baby boom wave. So be on notice that the 2023-36 boom should be stronger than the 2044-56 boom to follow, and that we may not see the Dow higher than 22,000 again, adjusted for inflation. Dave Okenquist and I have made estimates of birth rates and immigration trends that are lower than the mindless straight-line projections pumped out by mainstream experts. We take into account predictable cyclical downtrends, especially the demographic ones, which everyone else ignores. I predicted, in advance of the 2007 top, that births and immigration would decline.